This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
With alarming new research, I've been saying that the dreaded 2 degrees C of warming is unlikely, even with geoengineering. So why are some officials still talking as though 1.5 degrees is the goal? Finally, I think more realism is emerging, partly due to stunning new emissions figures from China. Andy Pittman, director of the ARC Center for Excellence for Climate Extremes, told the Sydney Morning Herald newspaper, quote, "Most climate scientists think 2 degrees to be aspirational," end quote. While all industrial nations have failed to slash emissions, the story from China appears to be worse. We've reached Dr. Josep Canadel, known as PEP. He is the longtime executive director of the Global Carbon Project and a research scientist for the Commonwealth Scientific and Industrial Research Organization, or CSIRO, in Australia. PEP is an author in more than 150 peer-reviewed science papers and a member of the Nobel Prize-winning 2007 IPCC Fourth Assessment Report. From Canberra, Australia, PEP Canadel, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thanks. My pleasure to join you.
There was a lot of good news coming out of China over the past few years. Mass transit there is booming along with the world's largest solar buildup. We heard Chinese coal plants, the binge of building was ending. But what do actual emissions measurements tell us?
Well, I mean, I think that we had incredible good news over the past 3 years when we realized that China really peaked its coal emissions in 2013. And since then, those emissions have either kind of stabilized or going down. And so we had a very short period of great excitement. Now, the very latest peak into the energy consumption for the first 3 months of this year, coming straight from China statistics, are not looking great. So basically, the statistics are showing us that energy demand and therefore the carbon associated with most of the energy being based on coal, gas, and oil will lead to higher emissions of these first 3 months than any other time we've seen in over the past 7 years. So that's not encouraging news. Even the statistics only refer to the first 3 months of the year.
Are we still dependent on reporting from each government, or is there an outside sort of scientific way to also measure the greenhouse gases?
So we do it two ways. So basically, most of the statistics are developed through the national reporting back to the UN, you know, statistic departments, and they kind of compile it all. There are other ways which are kind of more what we call top-down ways, where trade statistics of energy between countries and what is known as the production of the various countries kind of comes together in a few large bodies like BP and the International Energy Agency and some of our own emission work that we do in the Global Carbon Project. And these are kind of complementary. Sometimes they're kind of rougher. They're really good to understand the global emissions. But, of course, they're less good to kind of dive into details of each country. You really need to look at what the country reports are. And I might say very quickly that China's reporting has increased in quality tremendously over the last 10 years. They're doing a really accurate job at trying to get better and better all the time. So, yes, there's a lot of changes all the time, but there's a really good intent to do a good reporting.
Were you surprised by the growth of China's greenhouse gases recently, and do you think it's possible even the Chinese government was also surprised?
Well, we were surprised. I mean, we're surprised because we were so excited about, you know, we've been doing this work for decades, and, you know, the only thing you've seen over the decades is an acceleration of global carbon emissions. So we were very excited to see over the previous 3 years, you know, this kind of a slowdown, largely but not exclusively coming from China, and the fact that it seemed not to be fully real or not sustainable, so that this year we're very likely to go up again. So last year emissions went up. China had a little increase, but it was a small one. So we still fell. Look, China has kind of mostly been stable for 3 years, now a fourth year. It just goes up a little, not a big deal. But yes, this year it just looks that growth can be even bigger. So we are surprised. We're excited about global peak emissions. Peak emissions is a requirement, is an urgent requirement for almost any aspirations of low climate stabilization. So anything that has to do with, you know, 1.5, 2, and even, you know, a little more than 2 really requires that global carbon emissions peak like almost now and from forward begin to go down very quickly.
So we're going in the wrong direction still. And I thought that the big hydroelectric plants in China, like the Three Gorges, would help cut coal dependence. But there was a problem?
The problem is that China and globally, we're just asking for more and more energy. So the per capita energy demand is increasing. That is, the amount of energy that each person is consuming is going up. And also, the overall population is going up. So every year, we have an increase in the energy demand that would need to be supplied exclusively by renewable energy so that we don't keep growing on emissions. And eventually, well, not eventually, very quickly, that renewable energy would need to be replacing, you know, the old fossil fuel infrastructure. Well, that's not happening. So what's happening is that, for instance, the last few years, we've seen growth in energy demand, and that growth in energy demand has been met by about 40% from renewable energy, which is extraordinary and unprecedented as well. But the rest of the 60% of the energy growth, you know, the demand growth, has been met with more fossil fuel emissions. And particularly natural gas and oil is really growing really fast and strong. Coal overall globally has a stabilized quite.
The United States and Europe, as you know, Pep, used to be the giants of carbon pollution. How much of the global total is now coming just from China?
Yeah, so about 27%, and 7% from Europe, and double of this from the U.S. So, yeah, so you have a steel now China, double than the next emitter, which is the U.S., and then U.S. being double of the conglomerate of European Union.
Well, you know, I'm in Canada, and Canadians are very high energy consumers, I have to say. And despite all the warnings from scientists and activists, we just haven't slashed our emissions. But what kind of cuts do we need from the original developed countries to make some room in that atmosphere for these other nations to grow?
Basically, globally, we should be decarbonizing completely our energy system, you know, by mid-century. This is an incredible feat. But, you know, one could argue there's no reason why technology can be accelerated, a big deal. We still have 30-plus years to go. So it's not totally out of this wall of possibilities. Now, in order to answer the question you're after, which is, well, sure, you know, we cannot be demanding the same from India and Africa in terms of emission cuts than we should ourselves, the kind of the richer, more developed world. And so that really puts the deadline for full decarbonization much earlier than mid-century, you know. And whether it's 2040 or it's earlier, I don't think that anyone has the clear numbers. But just keep in mind that probably by 2040, the developed countries would need to be fully decarbonized. And fully decarbonization doesn't mean zero carbon emissions. You know, we still can play with a few things that would allow to have, you know, some emissions, but not too many. It will be still a decarbonization of perhaps of 90% of the emissions. So we're really talking about a full transformation of the energy system. But then you could play with whatever, you know, natural carbon things, you know, forests and better management practices in the agricultural world, or, you know, slowing down deforestation and degradation. So there's a few tricks we can use, but these are small tricks. You know, you still need to get rid of most of fossil fuel emissions unless, and we've been talking about these unless for decades now. That's why it's almost embarrassing to be talking about, unless we make work carbon capture and storage, which is taking the emissions from any coal power plant or gas plant, and we burn, you know, the fossil fuel, and we just capture all the carbon dioxide and we send it straight into the geological strata to stay there forever. We do know now enough that this system could work. We know that they're expensive. We know that they need to improve. but, you know, Canada is the one country in the world that has purposely built a carbon capture and storage facility associated to a coal power plant. And so, you know, if we were to repeat this thing thousands and thousands of times across the globe, we could still think about, you know, having perhaps some level of fossil fuel in our energy portfolio without the emission consequences.
You are listening to Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith with my guest Pep Canadel. He's the executive director of the Global Carbon Project. Now, in July 2011, there was a conference at the University of Melbourne titled 4 Degrees or More, Australia in a Hot World. The German climate scientist, Dr. Hans Schellenhuber, gave the keynote address, and we broadcast that on Radio EcoShock right away. And the mood then, Pepe, was what if? And now 4 degrees seems much more possible. Do you think scientists are moving along that continuum towards a world that could be much hotter than 2 degrees C?
So, yes. So, basically, I think that we need to kind of backtrack and think about, you know, when we say about 2 degrees, I mean, who asked for the 2 degrees? So, the 2 degree idea didn't necessarily came from the scientists. It came from policy. You know, originally came from the 90s, from the European countries, which they said globally we should stabilize climate at below 2 degrees because beyond then, because we think that is feasible and we can avoid the worst of climate change. But that was in the 90s. That's more than 20 years ago. And so here we are 20 years later. We've done very little other than grow emissions from greenhouse gases very fast, create a much bigger problem than ever we had, and we still are, you know, hanging on the 2 degrees. So here's where, you know, the problem comes from. And so the Paris Agreement, who now main goal is to stabilize the climate system below, well, 2 degrees from the industrial temperature. We are now so stuck with this kind of policy-driven 2 degrees that we had to invent new ways to actually, you know, try to reach those 2 degrees. But, you know, this is just now a number of, we need to go beyond decarbonizing. We need to, you know, go and start sucking up carbon dioxide from the atmosphere because decarbonizing the global energy system is just not enough. Now, can we still do the 2 degrees or are we really going well above and beyond? I mean, with our current emission trends, and with what countries all over the world have committed to the Paris Agreement to do over the next 12 years to 2030, which is the first big commitment of the Paris Agreement, we know that it's not the kind of trend that is going to lead us to well below 2 degrees. So if we just look at where we are and what people are telling us they want to do for the next 10 years, 12 years, you know, there's no way that then we can curve so quickly after that that we'll still be able to go 2 degrees. So we have already a huge problem just with what we are committed. Now, let's say we're going well past 2 degrees. I think that at this point, very likely, it's past 2 degrees. But I would say more than thinking that we may be going to the 4-degree arena, I'm not sure that we're going to go to the 4-degree arena. There's always surprises in their system. But from an emission point of view, I don't think that our economy and our society is going to be so stupid to kind of push the system and the economy to a point we're going to be cooking ourselves inside of it. I think that we're going to be much smarter, but, you know, much smarter can be still be, you know, well above 2 degrees, but without, I think, going to the extremes of 4 degrees that sometimes we have. Now, what's new, what I think that's new, is that we start seeing now some of the climate impacts coming already at 1 degree in ways that we didn't think quite they're going to come so early or they're going to be so clearly distinctive at already 1 degree over industrial. So this is perhaps to me a much bigger worry than the worry that we're going to go beyond 2 degrees. 2 degrees, there's nothing magic about it. 2 degrees, there's plenty of impacts. And what we're now realizing is that that 2 degree has nothing of being a safe target. That's really the issue that's emerging now.
Yes, I have to tell you, at supposedly at 1 degree, yesterday I drove through a flooded out neighborhood right near me in southern British Columbia, and it was record floods. Everybody dragged everything they had out to the street. The houses had been condemned. They have to be torn down. Hardly anyone has insurance. Their lives are wrecked along with their homes. The local businesses may never return. So as we see emissions accelerating, I think there's a really good chance that well before we get to something like 3 degrees, the economy could collapse because we're just going to get beaten up by these extremes in climate change. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, look, I'm a person that believes that, yes, humans are stupid, but humans are also very smart, and they don't see it there as they see everything, you know, crumbling down. Now, the problem we always say on climate change is that, yes, you may decide that at some point into the near future that that's too much, and then it's too late. So because too late in the sense of the Earth system has a dynamics, that this is not like we just kind of pollute this area and now we're going to just pour the billions to kind of clean it up. No, it doesn't work this way with the planet. So the planet has its own dynamics. We need to understand them. We do understand them quite a bit. And certainly you need to start doing things well before you're in hot water. And so, yes, there is a risk that we're going to just go into hot water before being serious. But I think that you're totally right. I mean, we're going to see big impacts in the economy. There's no doubt about it. And I just want to tell you a little about even Australia, which I really think that Australia, by being in this kind of area between semi-arid and the subtropical, tropical belt, we're an incredible continent to actually show how a lot of the impacts will unfold in other parts of the world because we are really monitoring this thing very well. And I want to bring out a few examples, which all have, you know, huge economic implications. So, of course, the example everyone has heard is the Great Barrier Reef, where the last past extreme event of El Nino, which is a condition when global temperatures kind of spike and then return back to a base. We had the most unprecedented coral bleaching ever recorded to a point where, you know, literally a third of, and when I say a third of the Great Barrier Reef means that 1,000 kilometers of coral reef, you know, had bleached at a very high level, up to 90%. I mean, unprecedented. The experts were saying you usually see the coral kind of starving when there's these episodes of, you know, hot water, and the starvation comes because the symbiosis that, you know, happens between the polyps and the green algae gets lost. The green algae disappears, and then the polyps starving because they don't have the carbohydrates that the algae give them. So they were saying that they've never seen a coral bleach, that there was no starvation. The coral just cooked. The temperatures were so high that in a week, literally the bleaching just occurred. Usually bleaching occurs over many weeks as the corals are starving. So, I mean, this is unprecedented. And, you know, we have a $6 billion industry based on the Great Barrier Reef, from fishing to tourism, and of course people all around the world and tourism all around the world were talking about whether it was really worthwhile to go and visit the Great Barrier Reef again. So huge implications. In the north, we had something that has never been recorded in Australia and was equally unprecedented globally. 700 kilometers of mangrove in a few months died back. We've never seen any kind of dieback of mangrove regions so important, so extensive up in the north. And there's no record that this thing has ever happened anywhere else. And again, it happened because the water temperatures were so high, coming from relatively below average rainfall the previous month. And so altogether, literally obliterated 700. And these mangroves are really important places for all the fisheries of the tropical fish in the north, where the nurseries are really, you know, happening. So all these things, tremendous implications for the economy of Australia. And there's been a few other incredible examples. In the south, in Tasmania, we had fire. I mean, forest fires in places we've never seen fire. These are relict forests from the last glacial period, 10,000 years ago. There's never been a fire. There's peat soils, which they've been built over thousands of years. You know, this thing very well in Canada. And so there was a fire that literally obliterated in just a few days, but were a forest of pines, which were 1,000 years old. and these peatland soils, which they built over thousands of years, which also they were consumed incredibly quickly. So, I mean, these are total collapse of ecosystems, which cannot be recovered. You cannot recover a thousand-year-old pine forest. You cannot recover multiple thousand-year development of a peat soil. So unprecedented, again, very related to the tourism industry of Tasmania, these alpine pristine forests. And so, again, we're seeing this thing at 1 degree. So I think that, you know, one needs to be start asking whether the 2 degree we talk so much has even been, you know, really a safe target in the first place.
Please tell us about the Global Carbon Project, what you do and why this project was put together in the first place.
Yeah, so the Global Carbon Project is a consortium of several hundred scientists all around the world looking at and putting together what we call the budgets of greenhouse gases, the carbon budget, the methane budget, the nitrous oxide budget. Budgets are important because they not only tell you, you know, how much carbon gets built into the atmosphere, which ultimately leads to climate change, but also tells you at a high resolution which sectors are contributing to those emissions. But in case of the carbon also, not all the carbon that we emit, actually only half of the carbon that we emit remains in the atmosphere and produce climate change. The other half gets absorbed by the oceans and absorbed by the vegetation around the world. So our role is also to really look very carefully the trends of carbon uptake in the ocean and on land, because if any of these trends were to change in the future, we would basically have a bigger fraction of the emissions staying in the atmosphere, leading to climate change. So we would be in accelerating mode. So the idea was to, because there were a lot of bodies doing various components, separate components of these carbon budgets and greenhouse budgets, we basically put the whole picture together, and we do it quite independently. It's a voluntary effort, and people contribute because they believe that what we're doing is of incredible value to the climate, the climate convention, to society, and to basically into the discourse about climate change and what humans are doing to our planet. So we're totally independent. And we do these releases of measure information and data delivery for everyone to actually use, see, check, challenge. And so we try to also align a lot of our products to what, for instance, you know, the Paris Agreement may require to have to track and assess progress or otherwise. And also back to the nations to really say, you know, what do you need the most to try to understand, to make good judgments on the position of a particular country. So we try to develop a lot of national level information, both for carbon sinks and carbon sources. So countries have also additional data above and beyond the data from their own departments and agencies that they may want to use to build a case for action.
And do you produce an annual report, or do you have a more regular stream of data that goes out to countries? How does that work?
Yeah, so we do a major annual report every year, and so all the data gets updated. And also we provide something that is exceptionally valuable to almost everyone, and that is about the carbon emissions of the very year we're releasing the data. And we do this release just before the Convention on Climate meets. They meet once a year, representative of all countries come together. So during that big conference, we release the new data, and we tell both the national state representatives and, of course, to the rest of the world, how well or bad we've done that very year in which we are. So we do a little bit also of projection just for the last few months of that year. And that's of incredible value, because this is almost immediate feedback to those people engaged in climate change action. And that includes both the governments and, of course, the NGO industries, who are all basically, you know, saying they want to do things. And we can provide almost instant feedback of what's happening that year. Incredibly valuable. And so we're trying to just now bring other gases and kind of more comprehensive assessments to the availability of everyone.
Yes, I think what you just said is very important, too, because we're getting the picture of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere, and some people know the parts per million and so on, But methane is becoming more and more important, and you mentioned nitrous oxide, and there are other very rare greenhouse gases that are extremely powerful. It would be good if the public knew more about the broad index of all the greenhouse gases that are going to affect the climate.
Yes. So it's a great point, and as I said, we're really working on this kind of more integrated package, but it's really important to understand that carbon dioxide, it's still not just quantitatively the most important gas, it's still the gas who ultimately will determine where we kind of stabilize the climate system. And the reason is that when you put like a ton of carbon dioxide, that ton of carbon dioxide, let's say that in about 100 years, about 60% of those emissions, so 600, if you put a ton, 600 kilos, will be removed from the atmosphere. And then you'll need 1,000 years more to remove the next 20. And then you need many thousands of years to remove the last 20, which means that a good part of the carbon that we put into the atmosphere, the carbon dioxide we put into the atmosphere, it's there forever. Even if in the millennia scale gets ultimately removed and going into the ocean, of course, that's not a scale that is relevant to humanity. We still want to be here in 1,000 years, but surely, you know, for the actions we need to take and the care we need to take for our next generations, carbon dioxide, it's almost like, it's an irreversible emission to some extent. That's why we put so much emphasis on CO2, not just because, whatever, carbon is cooler than methane or N2O. And yes, the other ones, they continue to go up, and we do need to deal with them. There's absolutely no doubt about it. But as I said, in the long horizon, let's say, you know, over the next 100 years, can we stabilize 2 degrees or 2.5 or 1.5? Carbon dioxide is the one that dictates the most, you know, what's possible and what's not possible, because it's that irreversibility nature, almost irreversibility nature of it.
You know what? I'm going to disagree with you a little bit, and I'm nobody to disagree. But the thing is, you just talked about very extreme things that had happened in Australia that had not been seen before and that can't be reversed. And they happened in a pretty short period of time. So if we have a burst, say, of methane, and let's say methane only really stays very active for 10 or 12 years in the atmosphere, in that 10 or 12 years, we may suffer extreme damage. So it does matter, too, what happens in the short term, I think.
Radio EcoShock.
We will be right back in a minute to finish our conversation with Pep Canadell, the director of the Global Carbon Project.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org.